Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
What the Public Banking Act does that I think is so revolutionary is it recognizes social purpose investments as defined by the federal government, by state regulators and investment authorities as well, as money, that debt issued for the purpose of making public bank loans, targeting the restoration, the sustainability, the reparation of social, environmental, and economic inequalities, and the need for development across a wide base, that such lending projects, which can be defined in lots of ways, they can be placed at the Federal Reserve as collateral for this discount window you're talking about.
That's today's guest, David Jetty, talking about one of the most important legislative initiatives in support of public banking in America, the Public Banking Act, just introduced publicly by Congresswomen Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It is a true breakthrough, and today we're going to take a close look at how it would modify our current fiscal and banking organization. The changes would be very significant. And it's a positive step toward having our money system serve the public interest. Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus and Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. This proposed Public Banking Act is perhaps the most exciting element to appear on the national horizon for public banking since we began working in this arena 10 years ago. While we're not under any delusions about its immediate prospects in the halls of Congress, it's important that we acknowledge the breakthrough importance it deserves in furthering the evolutionary process of reclaiming public control of our money from the private capital cartels and government systems that serve them. This is a serious and well-thought-through piece of legislation that anyone interested in public banking really should spend some time learning about. And we're delighted to have such a knowledgeable guide to help us with that today during this program. So let's talk with Ellen about it. Well, Ellen, today we have a special guest, a colleague of ours from California, David Jetty, who's been working with the California Public Banking Alliance and of late has been involved in a very exciting breakthrough for public banking nationally. Through the services, the offices of Congresswomen Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who have proposed a Public Banking Act. Big breakthrough here because what it does is opens up a space within the current federal framework for the public interest to be served. By supporting and codifying public banks.
What I particularly like about this bill is that it establishes parameters for us to have access to the Fed's discount window at 0.25% at the moment. So in other words, it puts us at the same level as other private banks in having access to the Fed, which is something that we definitely want and need. So we need that. But what's interesting to me is that the Fed actually needs us. They need public banks. You know, the Federal Reserve has been sort of begging Congress to do more stimulus, because the only tool they have is to buy bonds. I mean, that's how they do their quantitative easing. Even they buy government bonds or they bought mortgage-backed securities, et cetera, but some sort of debt, buy some sort of package debt, or they've got their the new facilities, but anyway, always they're buying debt and they buy it with reserves. They do not buy it with anything that comes into the real economy. So right now we've got millions of people out of work and the Fed actually has two mandates to maintain the stability of the currency, which means don't let it get too inflationary, et cetera. and to maintain full employment. And, you know, where are they on this full employment thing? Why aren't they out there? Milton Friedman said it's easy to cure a debt-based depression, which is what we're in right now. He said all you have to do is fly helicopters over the people and drop money on them. So where are the helicopters? Why isn't the Fed doing it? The answer is they can't. They really are not allowed to drop money into the real economy. They can only drop money into Federal Reserve accounts of banks. You know, we've got a two-tiered system. We've got the reserve system, and then we've got deposits, which are created by banks when they make loans. And the deposits are our circulating money supply. And that's where almost all of our money comes from. I mean, a little bit is, I mean, even physical dollars printed by the Fed, and they're called Federal Reserve notes, can't be spent by the Fed into the economy. All they can do is either lend them or sell them to banks. And if the banks do not then lend them on or create deposits on their books in the form of loans to consumers or businesses, local businesses, then the money does not get out there into the real economy. So, and the banks are not lending right now. It's very difficult for small businesses to get loans because they're considered very risky. I mean, nobody knows what's coming. We got all these lockdowns. Will they ever make any money? Will they be able to pay their loans back? Mm-hmm. So the Fed is, or sorry, the private banks are reluctant to lend into the real economy. But public banks will lend into the real economy. That's what they're for. They are mandated to lend into the real economy, and they can do it and still make a profit or at least break even. That's the thing. They don't even need to make a profit. They just, you know, they should break even, and then they'll be stimulating the local economy, which will be good for the government because it will be increasing the tax base and GDP, et cetera. So public banks can do it at a profit because they've cut out all the middlemen. So they've cut out all the leaks where all the profits go. So they can turn those profits right back into the local economy. Now that assumes that they can tap into the Fed like big banks do at 0.25%. Why the Public Bank Act is a good thing. It's mm-hmm. this framework for public banks working with the Fed. But I would argue, and am arguing in the article I'm writing right now, that the Fed needs us. We are the tool that they're missing, which is a banking system that will use the access to the Federal Reserve to feed the local economy. Now, a lot of people say, well, so why did the stock market go up when the Fed does their quantitative easing? How's that money get out there? The Fed is only allowed to deal with these 22 primary dealers. Yeah. And many of them are banks, but many of them are not. They're like investment type financial institutions. And they actually do have to make a profit, and they have to spend their money somewhere. And they're investment institutions. So it goes right into investments, which means yeah. right into the stock market. So that's why asset prices go up, because that effect where whoever has first access to the money gets uh-huh. a good deal. And of course, if the banks are making loans, they're lending to their big rich corporate clients that they like, maybe Amazon or something that they know is going to be profitable. And so that money's going out there, but it's not trickling down into the real economy where it really needs to be. And public banks will do that. They'll get it to the small businesses and to the homeowners and to the on the ground needs.
The real economy, the real productive economy, as opposed right. to the speculative one. I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that the Federal Reserve doesn't reach the people directly, that they have to work through that middle tier of private enterprises that take the money directly from the Treasury through the Fed. And that's the way the money gets distributed. Well, no wonder that the Federal Reserve is not our bank. It's supposed to be the central bank of the United States serving the citizens. It doesn't. It's serving Wall Street first, and then maybe through one of its special lending programs, enable us to get some money for cities and states and so forth. Who, I mean, you know, we've talked about this before. The, you know, the fact that cities and states have to go begging to Wall Street to borrow money for their, if they were members of the Fed, as the Public Banking Act that we're going to talk about in a minute proposes, they'd be able to go directly to the window like everybody else and get their money super cheap. Not like everybody else, but like the special lending tiers would be allowed to do. So basically, this Public Banking Act then is setting the stage for the Federal Reserve to take on kind of a new identity, or at least an additional identity, in which it is serving the public interest and public needs, really codifying a whole list of provisions and regulations and oversights and accommodations for public banking in America. It's very exciting. And even though, you know, who knows what will happen with the legislation after it gets thrown into the sausage grinder in D.C. But our conversation with David should be really enlightening. He's a terrifically bright guy who really knows a lot about this particular act. And I think it'll be a great way to start off a new year to have the Public Banking Act on the frontier, along with what we've been talking about in previous shows about the National Infrastructure Bank, also on the legislative track in D.C. In the coming year. So let's go talk to David and hear all the details.
Okay.
We're very happy to have today a special guest, David Jetty from California Public Banking Alliance, who has been instrumental or involved in helping two congresspeople, Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, bring forward a new piece of legislation, which we're very excited about at Public Banking Institute and others around the country. It's called the Public Banking Act. And it's intended to, we're hoping it will be brought to the Congress next session as a breakthrough in the consideration of public banks and codifying public banks as part of our governmental structure. David has been really an instrumental financial advisor to the public banking efforts in California. And I know his expertise has meant a great deal to the congresspeople. So welcome, David. Thank you for being with us. Tell us about the Public Banking Act and how you got involved with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. We at California Public Banking Alliance, we're a bunch of volunteer advocates for public banks from all different areas of climate and economic and racial justice. Came across this opportunity. Rashida Tlaib's office, a congresswoman, reached out to some of our compatriots in San Francisco who turned us on to this. And we were lucky enough to join some calls and to work a little bit on the bill as it was being written. We were able to work with Rowan Gray, who's a professor of law, who was working on this and as part of, I believe, Americans for Financial Reform, is one of the groups that's involved with it as well. Raul Carrillo and obviously Congresswoman's staff are the folks who wrote the bill, but we were able to come in and give a perspective as public banking advocates, people in the space who kind of focus on this issue and who have been working on it at a state level. And we were really pleased with where it started. We're even more pleased with the suggestions they did take from us. And we're really happy to come out and talk about it, especially with people in the public banking world.
And what does it do?
Well, first of all, it doesn't make any public banks, right? It just lays out the rules for what public banks will be in the federal context. Most public bank efforts to date, including well back into our public bank's history, have been local efforts or state efforts. This is a federal recognition of public banks. It creates classifications for public banks and kind of sets up the lanes and the guardrails to keep them on the path of serving the public, on the path of safety and soundness and compliance with regulatory rules, and on the path of not, you know, financing things like fossil fuels or overpaying executives, both of which are in the bill.
And there are two types of banks. They're talking about public payment banks and public lending banks.
That's right.
What's that distinction about?
Well, one of the big troubles with banks, largely, is that when they fail, they kind of take down our payment system with them. And we saw this in 2009 when it's not just that the assets that banks were producing, like collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities, that bundled bad assets in with supposedly good assets and then rated them AAA, those lost their value. And that would matter to basically everyone, because obviously the debt matters a lot, whether you're a lender or a borrower, and lots of assets, lots of government spending is based on the value of homes, all these things. But a secondary effect of the failure of those lending institutions is that all of a sudden banks fail. So even if you didn't invest in any products, you just had your money in a savings account, without insurance from like a depository, there would be a collapse of our regular use of currency. And the FDIC is there to protect us from that. It insures deposits up to $250,000. But that essentially is a subsidy. It's a government backing to private deposits, right? Private banks are accepting these deposits and they're using them to leverage and make loans. And they're backed up for any failure up to this level by us, the taxpayer. So in imagining a public banking bill, my understanding is that, you know, the federal lawmakers that are working on this want to address this issue from the beginning in a public banking system and to have banks concentrate on what they do best. A lot of this has to do with not just creating public banks, but looking at what needs to happen in banking in general, right? Payments are payments, meaning being able to access your wages and buy things, right? We call it payments in kind of the fintech and banking world, but really we're talking about cash, money, right? We don't use paper money nearly as much as we used to. Plenty of people still do. Those services are social infrastructure, right? Being able to use money is just like using a train or a street, right? So access to that needs to be universal. Right now, we have to access it through depository institutions that want to sell us all sorts of other products and use our money to fund so many other things. So if the payment system could give you direct access to money as it really is, right? Give you access to a Fed account, an account at the Fed, then there's much less intermediation between you and the currency. So public payment banks are designed under this law to provide that service and to integrate with those innovations in the payment sphere. On the other side, you have lending, right? And this is the leverage of capital to go out and make loans and collect interest, and often to then take those loans and bundle them into investment products. And that is a function that's purely, you know, it's a private entities almost universally that perform that function. And it's the most lucrative part of the financial world. It's a very low risk when you're dealing with certain kinds of loans, especially government debt. So these are functions that could very easily be brought into public banks, as we all know. And that's the route that the Public Banking Act opens for those types of banks. And it recognizes them independently. And it also requires the FDIC to deal with them as special public banks, to give them special insurance that accommodates the uniqueness and this, the different circumstances under which public banks are founded. Also requires the Federal Reserve to give them membership and access to liquidity, discount window, things like that.
So I wasn't aware that there are two classes of banks. So how do you do that? I mean, let's say we're talking about the banks that we're working on in California. Which ones are payment banks and which ones are the other depository banks?
Well, yeah, there's payment banks and lending banks.
Lending banks, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good question. And honestly, it comes back to, you know, what do these localities want? Technically, under the law, if you're founding a bank in California, we have AB 857, which passed in 2019. That's an explicit law that lets cities and counties start banks and asks our state regulator to charter them. the Public Banking Act recognizes state-chartered public banks as sort of a third category. It assumes that the state has regulations that might divide them into these categories or might not, might allow them to carry certain services or not. But if you want to charter under a state law, you would use that category and you're not forced into one of these two buckets. But for example, a post office bank, a postal bank, that's most likely going to be some sort of payments bank, a bank that is given, that is offering payment services, short-term credit, debit card access, these kinds of basic money services to consumers, and then does that very cheaply by connecting directly with the Federal Reserve payment system instead of leasing that service out. Any deposits that are taken might actually be sent to a partner public lending bank where those monies can be custodied and then earn interest against lending activity that's leveraging that capital on behalf of social purpose loans.
What's really exciting to us about it in many aspects of it is that you're really specifically bearing down on the notion that banking is a public utility, should be a public utility. And it creates a framework for us to get away from the dominance and the absolute control of the private profiteering model for banking. And that, of course, is fundamentally the biggest breakthrough in my mind. And all of the advantages that it provides to cities and counties and states to be able to have access to the Federal Reserve in a much more generous and available way.
The idea is that banks, large corporations, Walmart, Chevron, they have access to the Federal Reserve window right now through the Fed's propping up of commercial paper, right? Right now, the Federal Reserve, it went out, it bought a ton of commercial paper, shored up confidence in that market. They would claim that they did the same thing in municipal debt, but we haven't seen the real crush of municipal debt, right? Corporate paper was going to drop off the cliff during the recession much faster, but it's going to be budgets for public entities over the next year that are going to really suffer, and their borrowing capacities are going to diminish. If they were given equal treatment, you know, if the state of California had equal treatment to Walmart and Chevron at the Federal Reserve, then we would not be facing huge layoffs of teachers and firefighters in the coming years, which is going to happen. And part of that is because there's no institutional priority. There's no institutional right to use the banking system as the large investor and economy that California truly is. I mean, the Central Bank of Greece would not tell the economics minister of France or the Netherlands that under no circumstances would their debt be considered a part of the Eurozone's collective debt, right? Whereas in the United States, we've fully federated our debt, and California must make these cuts. And as a result, we're actually, and we're under a similar problem as Greece, who doesn't have the political power to influence the European currency. But how do we not have that power in California? Yeah. It's backwards. And the reason is because that is a private franchise of a public service of banking.
To me, the biggest advantage of a public bank, or what we want, is access to the Fed's discount window at 0.25% currently for all banks in good standing, which we assume our banks would be. But if you've got this split bank situation, you've got all the deposits in one bank and you do the lending in the other bank, where do you get your liquidity? Do you get it all from the Federal Reserve? Do we get the same privileges that other private banks get? I know the reserve requirement has been eliminated. So theoretically, you know, banks can just lend till the cows come home and borrow directly from the Fed. Can we do that?
They can only lend till the cows come home insofar as they lend to products they can place back at the Federal Reserve as collateral. And the discount window, you know, what we've heard from the Federal Reserve is that it's not for long-term lending, right? And what that means is you're not really allowed to go to the Federal Reserve window and take out a 100-year loan at 0.25%. What you are allowed to do is move assets on and off your balance sheet into forms of cash, either debt forms of money or these cash forms of money. And what the Public Banking Act does that I think is so revolutionary is it recognizes social purpose investments as defined by the federal government, hopefully by state regulators and investment authorities as well, as money. That debt issued for the purpose of making public bank loans, namely loans targeting the restoration, the sustainability, the reparation of social, environmental, and economic inequalities, and the need for development across a wide base of beneficiaries, that such lending product projects, which can be defined in lots of ways, but that they can be placed at the Federal Reserve as collateral for this discount window you're talking about. So when you ask, how do you get liquidity for these banks if you're not running lots of payments through them and keeping a huge balance of cash from your depository customers? The answer is that public banks will take public capital, lend against it, and then take those assets, public bank loans made to water projects, climate projects, UBI programs, and place them back at the Federal Reserve. Or really, you won't even need to do that. You'll be able to sell them on a secondary market. Why? Because the Federal Reserve's guarantee will create the risk profile and return profile necessary for those assets to find their way into institutional investment portfolios. And this is why banks can lend at these big multiplicative rates. It's not just the mechanism of the Federal Reserve. It's the confidence of the Federal Reserve, the long-term impact of having being able to balance your liquidity risk against things like treasury bonds, other low-risk assets that the Fed will currently take, and being able to earn interest and arbitrage against those assets across a big, big portfolios, right? So if these banks are making loans to these guaranteed products, they will be able to rotate public capital through them into private markets, but also back onto the Fed's balance sheet, especially during downtimes when there is no secondary market, which is when liquidity is most important.
So do you perceive any downsides to this bill? In other words, are we giving up any of the potential that we had just by forming state-chartered publicly owned banks?
Well, the example of the Bank of North Dakota is always really illustrative, because you look at that and you say, well, here's a bank that didn't have to join the FDIC. At the beginning, it wasn't a member of the Fed. It didn't have to play nice with Wall Street, and it didn't have to really worry about federal regulators. But it was also founded in 1919, and a lot has changed in banking since then. And certainly the parties and the political atmosphere around federal regulation of banks has really changed. I mean, I think we can all agree that it's unlikely the Republican Party is going to advance a bill that's going to create the recognition for public banks. Maybe I'm wrong. And certainly I would welcome a bill from Republicans that would create public banks, right? I honestly would. But I don't see it as coming. So when you think about where such a bill is going to come from, then you're probably going to see it from people who favor federal regulation of banking and more regulation of banking. Now, the desire to regulate banks comes from the obvious fact that banks are not trustworthy and have failed many times. And it's also prudent to know that public banks will not be perfect and will also fail. We'll have corrupt people that run them sometimes, and they'll also run into negative economic circumstances that are beyond their control. And it's up to the federal government to protect consumers and the general money system. That's their stated mission. So they will have to go through with that. My experience in talking to both state and federal regulators and policymakers, the desire to kind of squeak in a state bill that takes advantage of the constitutional separation of the state, beyond just the fact that there are federal and state charter bills, but that somehow the depository institution would not need deposit insurance, is really not politically palatable, and it's not clear how technically it would be regulated, right? Who precisely would make sure that the depositors, obligations are met to depositors? It's unclear unless you do have the FDIC, which is the primary regulator that does that.
So my understanding is the reason that banks are able to create money on their books, as we know they do, they create deposits, and that's where most of our deposits come from. I mean, the Federal Reserve has in its mandate to stimulate, maintain full employment, but it can't do it. It really has no way to get money out there, because all it can do is create reserves. And if the banks don't make loans, the money does not get into the real economy. So mm-hmm. it's to me the way to get the money into the real economy is to have a public bank network that is mandated to make loans into the real economy. Mm-hmm. But if you're not a depository bank, if some other bank is taking the deposits and you're making the loans, are you able to still create deposits on your books as all banks do?
You can create a deposit on someone else's books. It doesn't have to be on your own books, right? I can send a wire out of, so let's say for example, because I always like Ellen Brown, bank A, bank B type models, because it's easy for people to kind of picture, but you've got bank A, right? And you've got bank B. Bank A is going to make a loan and to a consumer who uses bank B. Bank A can send a wire to bank B and put that money on bank B's books without being a depository institution. The most important thing is that at the end of the day, bank A has the appropriate amount of reserves to legally meet its requirements in terms of its risk.
Right now it's zero. The reserve requirement at the moment is zero.
It's not though. There are international banking regulations and common risk weighting. And also just, you know, but the investors in banks want to make sure that banks don't get overextended. And it's not just a systemic problem, but also an internal economic problem. Whenever you give firms, and a public bank would still be a firm, as distinct from the federal government, right? They're going to have discretion and they're going to be focused on their own balance sheet only. So yes, banks can create money through lending, but any individual bank is limited by risk. And these are all small banks. They're intended to be. If we wanted to simply lend money against our monetary power, currently, politically, it is Congress that does that, and it does it through public spending, which is effectively a loan because that money has to come back in taxes. They're providing public services in exchange for everyone paying their taxes and the money coming back. But they're not paying back anyone. They're paying back the currency, right? These public banks are able to create money insofar as they're able to leverage risk and charge interest. They are not going to be able to take let's say a large deposit pool, which must by law remain liquid like public assets, and suddenly turn them into loan paper where they are no longer liquid. The Public Bank Act absolutely regards these banks as normal banks that have individual firm limitations on risk. So they have to be subject to FDIC deposit insurance.
And the FDIC would have a new variant for public banks.
And it would, yeah.
Different. Yeah. So,
yeah, the idea there is that public banks will have unique circumstances. For example, one thing that Ellen, you say a lot is like, why would a city make a run on their own bank, right? Like, why would you need deposit insurance when you can just cut yourself a check for whatever money you need for right now? Your deposits are more or less irrelevant so long as you are a form of a monetary authority, right? Like, if I have a bank and I can cut checks and make deposits, then really, what do I need deposited money for at all, right? That's the question that comes up when there's no one asking what your risk weighting is in your bank. But we need public deposit insurance to consider the fact that a public depositor in a public bank is a uniquely low risk insurance play, right? It's very different than if there's a big scare and there's a run on all these banks. Like, even if that was the case, that at a wide scale in a major depression, that would still not happen to public banks, right? The risk to the insurance fund is extraordinarily low. And as such, it should be extraordinarily cheap. And it should be very probably permissive relative to the risk weighting I'm talking about. Because again, you're talking about a much different type of institution.
If all banks in good standing can now borrow at 0.25%, even if it's only for 3 months, there's not going to be any runs on the banks. I mean, they have access to liquidity, right? So that's fear. So
yeah, it is. Well, no, I mean, you could argue the FDIC has got a lot of money sitting totally idle and investing in presumably institutional assets. For no reason, because of that exact reason, right? Banks can always get more money if they need to. The Fed has made sure that there is no question about that. And it's not just for FDIC deposits, right? The 0.25 at the window is for all that stuff over 250,000. That's there so that very large capital accounts don't move their money into other countries. That's why they throw that door open, because all of us regular people, we're covered by the insurance fund, which would probably fail if we actually need to hit it, but.
And also because the Fed does not want to have to guarantee the repo market, which is like hedge fund.
They have done, though. They've stepped into it multiple times over the last year, right? Yeah.
But not lately. I mean, apparently the...
So the bill kind of creates a different architecture for public banking, even though they're the same mechanical operation as the private banking. It'll be requiring a different level of expertise, sensibility on the part of the Fed to kind of bifurcate its their mindset. You know, we're doing this for the profit market or for the commercial market. We're doing this for the public market. That's kind of a, it's an evolutionary step, isn't it, on an institutional basis?
It certainly is. And I don't think the Federal Reserve is staffing up that part of their organization yet, but they are an agency of the federal government, you know, in manner of speaking, and they will follow Congress's law. And it kind of doesn't matter what the Federal Reserve thinks about public banks if Congress tells them precisely how to handle them. But I think that like other financial innovations, like other government oversight that we now take for granted. But, you know, in a Wild West world or in a less technological world, a less nationally and even globally connected world would have seemed strange. Like if you tried to explain the ETF to a silverback farmer, you know, in 1900s, it would have seemed pretty far-fetched. And I think that pretty soon, you know, within a generation, the Federal Reserve's public bank department will be robust and full of lots of graduates from all the best finance schools who are looking for ways to apply their financial acumen to public service, which is kind of an oxymoron right now. So we think that this sets the stage for that. Likewise at the FDIC to create categories for public banks and more largely to create, you know, markets for public bank products. Once you have the federal government giving clarity around an asset or an instrument, that takes a lot of cost out of it, right? You no longer need to de-risk that asset thinking about what regulations will be in the future. We're told this constantly by conservatives who want less or less changing regulation. Well, there's a lot of public banks that are getting started right now. So some clarity, some certainty around federal regulation would also allow them to boom and participate in the recovery.
I'm still back at the split bank idea. So this does remind me of the NEED Act, where you have your choice of putting your money into a lending bank and then you would make some interest. Then the question is how many people want to put their money at risk? But you said if the deposits move over into the lending bank, that's where they can make some interest. Is this a choice whether your deposits are in a payment bank or a lending bank? You see what I mean?
Sure. I think you're drilling into this idea of money as a savings item, and where is that done, and does that happen at banks? And to a certain extent, it can. Yes. There will be depository banks that will hold deposit accounts. This bank allows for fiscal agent status, where public banks can take a consumer deposit and then place it at the Federal Reserve, where it will earn interest effectively as a reserve, and that interest can flow directly back to the consumer. This is about disintermediating the access to that savings account for that consumer, right? As opposed to using that reserve leverage power to make more loans, let's say at home, right? The idea being that you should not necessarily be placing your deposits at risk on behalf of risky investment behavior, even potentially public lending behavior. So rather than taking the ring from Sauron and using it for ourselves, we must throw the ring into Mount Doom and forge a new path, right? Leveraging money as a savings object to then turn around and create financial profit is inherently tying our payment system to the judgment of lending officers. And we think we can do it better, that's for sure. But we want to make sure that people that are investing in public good products are doing so with their eyes open, and we're not over leveraging the money system on behalf of any particular activity. Financial services is social infrastructure because it's the intermediate to all of our productive activity. So insofar as we're creating banks, we need to have our eyes open as to who can use them, and for what purpose, right? If we create banks that take deposits that only certain people can qualify for, then we have to look at what system we're continuing to perpetuate. And if I'm going to open a depository bank that's designed, let's say, to take very small deposits, then what kind of services am I offering them if their deposit doesn't work for the other side of my activity? Do you see what I'm saying? If your deposit isn't conducive to my lending, then I'm not going to take your deposit. And likewise to your lending. That's the situation we already sort of find ourselves in. There's a big difference between those depository accounts and big public, let's say, rolling balances, or the sort of inherent depository power of state actors, like the state of California. Okay. If the state of California has all of its money in a public bank and there's a sudden liquidity crisis with banks, there's not a problem for the state of California because it does have the institutional power to, let's say, meet its obligations to its employees, right? This is very, very different than a landscaper who has $700 in a bank that fails, right? Or $700 in a bank that decides, you know what, you're not profitable enough, public or private, to take this money, right? We're looking for public banks to solve all these problems. And one of those problems is that it's not profitable to provide depository or payment services to the underbanked. And it's my opinion, and this is not shared by everyone in the movement, that trying to tie payments and consumer services to, let's say, large-scale infrastructure projects, that you end up in a catch-22 of having to justify the safety of your deposits, the safety of your investments all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that if you try to get off the ground on a public bank by doing both of those things at the same time, I mean, we're trying it. It runs into a lot of problems. My intuition is that it's going to be banks that focus on one of those two that start. And it's clear from the federal legislation that folks working on this at the federal level agree that these are sort of two problems. You may not. Doesn't seem you do.
Yeah. It's just brilliant, David. It's such a joy to hear you go through to articulate how this works and what the considerations are. And it's very encouraging, of course, to hear that at the congressional level, at the federal level, we have some movement toward creating banking in the public interest. Part of this bill, the Public Banking Act, is to encourage to provide incubators, grants, to do some generative work in the field. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Banking Act has in mind in terms of stimulating the creation and support of public banks?
Yes. Yeah, so yeah, it directs the Treasury to create some grant programs to grant to cities and states and localities and districts, right? These smaller government entities to explore, to build business plans and even capitalize and do expense sharing, technology upgrades to create public banks. It also requires that those grants be non-matching so that all states of all various revenue levels and budget situations will be able to access it. And in doing so, I believe will shake up some of these state efforts. It gives us a really good answer when people ask us, you know, where can we get some money to start this proposal or improve this proposal? We can point to a national agenda for it. I also think that just having a national bill, you know, as imperfect as it may be, is a helpful lodestar to kind of direct national efforts and to give it a national reference point. You know, I think people are tired of hearing me talk about the Bank of North Dakota. It's a very interesting case, but I'd like having other things of national profile to point to. Some American Samoa, also great. It's good to have something on the horizon and in development. But this will be something that we can say, not only is it a national concern and there's all these state efforts, but it's tied into a wider Green New Deal and a wider stimulus program, which obviously we hope it's included in a stimulus plan.
And of course, it is also addressing the issue of the unbanked or the underbanked and the access to postal banking. What does that intersection look like in this bill?
Right. So my understanding is that a postal banking system would probably come through post office legislation and possibly be chartered under this law, but possibly it Probably not. Right. The post office already has everything it needs to do to be a bank. So it doesn't really need to then go out and get chartered. But if it wants to take deposits and become a full-fledged bank, it could do so under this act or probably seek separate authorization. The mechanisms built into this act would more or less require, I think, post offices to integrate with some of these other programs like Fed accounts and e-cash, which is a concept from the ABC Act, where the Treasury creates basically a digital form of coinage, one that's untrackable and unassociated with individual data, but just kind of with a maximum amount, right, that you could use, sort of like Bitcoin in terms of a digital private public key pair to unlock the value, but limited in value in ways that would keep it from being used for money laundering. But the post office would be able to provide front-end access to these kinds of services. And then, of course, as a conduit for public savings bank or public lending banks, they could be a front end for those basic services. So if you wanted to be able to deposit part of your paycheck, first of all, you could cash your paycheck at the post office, and then you could also elect to save some portion of it, or possibly at a tax deductible, that'd be great, to put it into a public lending bank where it can add to a stack that's creating public bank lending in your community.
Could you articulate the Fed Direct business? There is now a Treasury Direct accounting that everybody could have, but it's really only for a very small limited functionality. How would this new...
Can I say, I think Treasury Direct is just for bonds.
For bonds, right?
For bonds.
Yeah. If you want to buy government debt, it's not really a depository.
Would this...
But Treasury Direct is a very good example of one of the things that that public financial institutions could build in terms of direct to consumer, direct to investor portals or windows into public debt. And if you house those things at a public bank, one that operates as sort of like a public investment bank, I know it sounds blasphemous, but if you had a public Goldman Sachs, right, then they would be looking at federal products as something that could be... they innovate around financial services, right? And the innovation always leads to, who asked you to do it, who's paying you to do it, right? So a public bank could be a place where financial innovation of a public nature could take place. And I know that innovation of all kinds can be scary and you need to do it with guardrails. Public banks can offer better guardrails than private banks, where everything happens behind closed doors, right? You can do things in limited series, but do it under the eye and within a context of public benefit. The Fed account system that's described or touched on in the Public Bank Act, it's not fully enumerated there, but it talks about public banks' access to it. The idea there is that rather than having deposits sit on the balance of private banks or small firms, which then become bank reserves, and somewhere in the middle lending is happening, that cash, there's no real reason why the Federal Reserve does not keep a ledger of all depository accounts. It's not that hard to keep track of numbers, and banks can still serve as the front end or a fiscal agent to your cash, which really sits at an account in the Fed. So that when you deposit your $500 from your work and you just want it on demand, that instead of it sitting in a private entity that's regulated to make sure it doesn't spend it wrong, it just goes right to the Fed. And the bank gets a little credit for putting it there. You get a little credit for putting it there. And then when you need to get it, the bank can come and get it for you. You can get it from any other bank. It disintermediates the deposit process and it takes it out of the risk pool.
I know we're running out of time, but could you just go into the ABC Act a little bit? Is that still alive, is it?
I think it's still introduced, or it's probably going to come back around. I'm not as studied on that. I've talked to folks who worked on it, so I know a little bit about it.
Background on what it is, Ellen, the ABC Act.
It's another. So ABC is another Tlaib bill. ABC stands for the Automatic Boost to Communities. And I believe it created some new spending. I believe it came with direct payments. A UBI during the pandemic, and it spun up digital dollars. So these are dollar balances consisting of dollar ledger entries that are liabilities on the account of the Federal Reserve, and then wallets that can access those, and then cash wallets that can access them at point of sale, and directing basically the Federal Reserve to open up checking accounts for everyone and then start dropping money into their accounts every month, right? The cheapest, fastest way to get dollars into people's hands without having to go through businesses that may use it, you know, use that to pay their kids, you know, their son who runs the shop and then shut the company down, or give it to Walmart and then they close down the store, or give it to Cheesecake Factory and they close down the restaurant, which is all the things that they actually did. Most of PPP, for example, went to white owned businesses, vast majority, huge businesses with very low per capita lending. This would be a direct UBI into federal accounts, the way I describe them. It would be a pretty smooth way to do it. And the beginning of an idea of a universal basic income.
Yeah, cool.
The objection I have seen a lot of by suspicious commentators is that we're talking about the Federal Reserve issuing Fed coins, basically a digital currency, like digital dollars. And this is the Federal Reserve, which is a bureaucratic, unelected, independent system. So I'd rather see, digital greenbacks or Treasury-issued dollars, not Fed-issued dollars.
Yes. Well, my friend and colleague, Raul Carrillo, is probably one of the national scholars or leaders in talking about the future of money and privacy, where these things intersect, and also how they intersect with cryptocurrency and how cryptocurrency hijacks a lot of these ideas and really turns them on their heads for their opposite purposes. I agree. You know, if you're going to get a Fed account, you're probably going to have to go through anti-money laundering, know your customer law, all the stuff from the Bank Secrecy Act. This more or less means that you have to identify yourself. If you're undocumented, if you don't want to be on the list of the federal government, then maybe you don't want these accounts. And it shouldn't be the only way you can access cash. There's no doubt. The eCash program, which is a little different, is from the Treasury. That is a digital currency, but it can be used without identifying yourself. Think of it like a coin that exists only when you enter your password. The coin doesn't have your name on it, but no one else can use it until you enter your password, right? And then when you give it to someone else, they can use it. And you can only have up to $100, right? This would allow you to have a cash-like asset, really probably like $500, a cash-like asset that could be on the internet that would not come with all the privacy points. And it's not just about the government having your information. It's about corporations like, and I say corporations, I mean multinational corporations, social media companies, tech companies that want to put you into a profile, control your credit, control what you see on television, control what you can and want to buy, and what's available to you generally. These kinds of social credit systems are extremely rampant. They are about to roll out in very, very large scales. And we definitely don't want a payment system that's intimately connected with it. As long as we're using private banks, we have no choice. You do not have a right to privacy for your bank account right now.
I'm anticipating a huge fight about this to the extent that the people will stand behind this initiative. And it would be a worthy fight, really a challenge to the essential pillars of our economy and our governance, because of how influential money, of course, is in terms of creating public policy. So this is the kind of an evolutionary breakthrough to democratize our financial system and to build on what we've got in a way that really serves the public. It's very exciting. Do you have any prognostications about the chances here? Or we just, we're living in hope, of course, but.
It's a major, act, and it's alongside a lot of other very ambitious efforts. I don't presume to know very much about what it takes to pass a law in the federal government. I've only been adjacent to efforts at the state level. I can tell you from the state point of view, it's like studying Brownian motion or something. It's like it's like quantum physics. The probabilities that have to add up to get to something specific are so astronomical. But when you find yourself there, kind of charting through the chaos, sometimes it's really helpful to have something in your hand that's all ready to go, when the moment does come.
Absolutely.
So I don't know whether, you know, this bill will have purchase in a McConnell Senate or even a Biden administration. But like I said, I think it serves as a very valuable lodestar for the movement. And I think it can improve if it doesn't pass right away, which makes it the script that all of us are writing, mm-hmm. us and our opponents, because they will make their impact on this as well. And the time, when the time comes to actually consider this, I think it's up to our movement around the country to support our best chances to create public banks, even if they don't match exactly what we want. This doesn't match exactly what I want. I don't think it always will. But, you know, there's a lot of talk of unity this week. There's a lot of talk of you know, what can realistically get done. I think a lot of that tends to fall back on progressive people or radical people or people who really want to see something happen to temper our expectations. And I think that's the wrong reaction to moments like this. I think we should be constantly imagining and manifesting what we want to see. And if you write something like this and you get behind it and you tell your representatives that you want it and you get them to vote for it, then it will pass. And it's as simple as that.
Got some recognition at the federal level.
Yes.
We definitely don't want the Fed opposing us. And the idea that if all it costs us is a little FDIC insurance, well, fine. But to have access to the Fed's discount window and all the tools that big banks have is excellent.
Yeah, David, I think what you've laid out for us is really extraordinary. Thank you so much for your expertise and your knowledge of how this all comes together. We are at this very exciting dynamic moment of change where the need for change is so expansive. And now, as you say, we put something together and we'll have something to build on and with as we move forward.
Yeah, and it can't go without saying that none of this would be possible without Ellen Brown and with Walt, your show, and with PBI. That you all have run the marathon, and we've taken the baton here at the end. We may cross the finish line, but we're doing it with you, and we would not be at this position without you. So thank you very much for your years of work on it.
Oh, likewise. And your enthusiasm and your youth and your energy is just great. I mean, you're not just you, but, you know, the whole grassroots movement is just super.
Well, and coming out of California, the history of you guys transforming what happened in California last year with public banking was just, it's a landmark for us all. So thank you. Thank you so much, David, for being with us on the show. And for the work that you're doing. And I know that we're going to be in touch along the way very soon.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.
Thanks once again to David Jetty of the California Public Banking Alliance, who has shared these insights into the new Public Banking Act as proposed by Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We'll be watching the progress of this legislation closely in future months, and we'll be discussing it in more detail here on It's Our Money. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.